Hello, I'm Richard Dockra. I'm a writer and consultant helping people to stand back and examine the big picture of life, human beings, politics, society and ideas. I'm the founder and director of the not-for-profit Life Squared and the social change agency ChangeStar. In this podcast series, I want to challenge your views of how we, human beings, think and behave. Most of us have a completely inaccurate view of the creatures we are, and the truth, revealed by researchers over recent decades, is mind-blowing and could change how we think about our lives and societies. In each episode, I'll be joined by an expert psychologist to explore one of humanity's biggest hopes or challenges, including seeking global peace, tackling the spread of misinformation, and preventing climate change. We'll ask whether each aim is realistic, given the creatures we are, and if we can't achieve them, what's the best we can hope for? In this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Daniel Jolly about fake news and conspiracy theories. We'll explore the psychology behind why people believe them, how these ideas can spread, and whether there's anything we can do to prevent them spreading and to protect the idea of the truth in society. Dr. Jolly is a senior lecturer in social psychology at Northumbria University in the UK and is a regular blogger and broadcaster on his specialist subject, the psychology of conspiracy theories. Here's the conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Daniel, our question here today is, as we've said just in preparation for this discussion, very pertinent at the moment. And it's, is it possible to stop people falling for fake news and conspiracy theories? And I think really we could start in a much broader question, and it's about the truth. And it's about our ability and our desire as human beings to actually seek the truth, whatever that is. So could we maybe just start by saying, you know, what is the truth and why does it matter to seek the truth and have a reasonably accurate view of reality around us?
So, of course, we all want to have the truth in our lives. It could be around politics, it could be around family, it could be around our own beliefs. But of course, the truth potentially is going to be clouded by our own judgments, our own biases, in a way, whereby people are going to look at the same piece of information potentially and look at it in a slightly different way. So me, as a psychologist, kind of akin to, you know, looking towards scientists, I do see the truth as potentially being black and white with regards to things that we can prove to be true. But with me saying that, I am fully aware that there will be people who are distrusting of scientists, of psychologists, of whoever it is, which means that whilst my perspective is this is the truth, this is what science has shown in an experiment or whatever it is, for example, to do with climate change, there's going to be another person who looks at that same piece of information, who's seeking the truth also, but will doubt the credentials, will doubt that scientific information, which I always find to be really interesting, that we all, you know, arguably have this need to find the truth, to be asking questions, to find the answer. But potentially our psychology, how we view the world, how we view that truth, could be clouded. And of course, we'll go into that a little bit later during the discussion. But for me, I find that particularly interesting. So my truth potentially is different to what you may say is the truth. And there could be debates around definitions of, you know, who is the person to see the truth. In a way, if you do not trust the gatekeepers of knowledge, well, then potentially you are going to be distrusting of, shall we say, that truth. And of course, the gatekeepers could be a whole range of people. It could be the scientists who I've mentioned, but it could be the governments of our world, whereby the governments are saying, well, this is what the truth is. We did an investigation into the death of a celebrity, the death of someone famous, or whatever it is, someone dying, as an example. And they're saying, this is what happened. But of course, if you were distrusting of those gatekeepers, you may project a conspiracy onto that celebrity death. A good example, Princess Diana, she was murdered by the UK government. Whilst there was an investigation, there's distrust. 9/11, again, there's an investigation to find out what happened. The report says one thing, but people who are distrusting of those gatekeepers of knowledge, the trust, well, they potentially believe something different. So back to the first question about truth. Potentially, it's your biases that maybe kind of override what you see the truth to be.
But presumably, we also have
a set of methods that we've established over hundreds or even thousands of years to actually arrive at a reasonably objective sense of the truth. So, for example, the scientific method. Perhaps there are some objective truths or the best that human beings can do at objective truths out there through, for example, the scientific method. But the take-up of that truth depends on actually people being willing to actually agree with it and be able to trust it, right? So it feels to me that there can be something that as close as we can get to objective truth through things like scientific method and doubt and using those things, but that is still dependent on people actually signing up to it and trusting it.
So I think that's a good point, signing up to it, that indeed we have that method there of current right now, the COVID vaccine, the method of how that particular thing, that particular vaccine was developed and the history behind how fast it's been, shall we say. But of course, someone who maybe doesn't understand the science behind it, doesn't have that trust in the gatekeepers, in this case, the scientists, the doctors, well, then they're going to be distrusting of that particular truth, which is, in that example to do with COVID-19, is quite problematic. And whilst the scientists around may kind of peer review and objectively and say, well, this is following the right patterns, it is not a rush thing because it's been going for quite some time, etc., etc. But that trust element, if that's not there, well, then you're not going to trust the truth because they're saying it for their own hidden agenda. They're saying it for profit. They're saying it for some kind of self-interest, which, of course, from my view, is not the truth. The vaccine is there, it's been developed. There will always be, you know, for me, outcomes that are undesirable, but it is safe. But of course, someone who doesn't believe scientists will not trust me saying that.
But it strikes me that there are some, you know, very clear reasons for why it is useful for human beings to believe the truth, and evolutionary reasons. For example, if you're, you know, if you're sat there in the savannas somewhere and you're waiting, you're trying to kill some animal, you know, thousands of years ago, you're going to want to know where that animal is. You're not going to want to believe in a story where, oh, it might be over there in the great beyond. You want to know realistically where it is so that you can expend the minimum possible energy to try and get it. You also want to be aware of any threats or things that are going to poison you. So again, this is where things like, you know, the basics of the scientific method arrived, I guess, is by people through trial and error, someone dying from drinking that thing and going, right, I'm not going to drink that. That is a bit of evidence that that is the truth, is that that is harmful. You know, so there seem to be some quite clear reasons why finding the truth or having an accurate view of reality works. And it's served us incredibly well. If you look at us in the modern age now, you know, we've got satellite technology, we've got mobile phones, we've got computers. That has only been possible through this attempt to kind of get at some sort of objective sort of model, even if it's just a representative model of what, you know, reality as best as we can looks like. So it feels to me that there are quite strong arguments for why it's useful for people to get to the truth.
Although I can see a counter argument to that, in the sense that evolutionary, if you were sat in the bush and there potentially could be another outgroup, another or animal in that bush, potentially having an overriding suspicion that something is out to get you, may actually protect you and your in-group, so your family, your friend, your in-group. So potentially believing in conspiracies that there's hidden plots against you and your society, so your group in that sense, actually could be an advantage in a way, because it means that whilst you're always on the defensive, you always believe people are out to get you, well, potentially someone could be out to get you, which means that if you're always on the defense, if someone comes out that bush, you're ready to go. So whilst that may have worked back when we were living like that, actually today it's a very different society. Having this potentially overriding suspicion that everyone is out to get you and your group, because of course it's very much a group thing, that you want to protect you and your in-group, your family, people who are close to you. If you're constantly on that defense where you think others are out to get you, well, that potentially could be quite maladaptive. So it may have been quite good at the time, but maybe indeed not now. So it's kind of I totally take your point on board about, you know, needing to know the truth and, you know, tracking things back evolutionary. But the counter argument also could be, well, if you're kind of always suspicious, you always could be protecting yourself as well. But of course, in today's era, that wouldn't, it's not seen to be a positive thing anymore.
So you've mentioned in groups and out groups, and I think it's important for us to talk about that. Absolutely. I mean, this moves us on quite well to sort of people's relationship with the truth. That we've talked a bit about the truth as an idea and why we seek it or why we might not. You know, what is our relationship with the truth as human beings? You know, from a psychological point of view, you know, are there some things that make us naturally inclined to seek something other than the truth? Because it would be fair to say that we're not exactly programmed, as it were, to seek the truth, are we? It doesn't work like that. Could you perhaps explain, you know, sort of some of our tendencies of thinking and behaviour and how they relate to that?
So, of course, you're more likely to trust someone who is in your group. So when I say in your group, it could be someone in your family, someone in your social network, in your workplace. You're more likely to trust someone that you know. An in-group member, as we refer to in psychology. And someone who seems to be different could be working at another competitor workplace, could be part of another group, out-group, as we call these groups. They're less likely to be trusted. They're seen to be different to you. And when you're trying to protect you and yourself, you are more likely to believe information that helps you other that other group. That, you know, believing bad things about the other group is going to appeal to you because it kind of meets maybe your stereotypes of that group, maybe your desire to be different. So when you're looking at the same piece of information, whether it could be online or just in conversations, when you hear something that is bad about that group, you're more likely to believe it just because it meets your prior beliefs. It meets what you expect that group to be like. And similarly, if you read something that is bad about your group, you're going to push back on that and go, that is absolutely not true, because that is just not true. So in a way, when it goes back to the, you know, the truth seeking, for me, it's potentially that bias, what we all have, where we may evaluate information quite differently based on that particular bias. And that's been shown in lots of different examples, but also conspiracy beliefs, whereby this bias that we have may make you believe that the other group is conspiring. And also, really interestingly, in America, they find over many different polls across many, many years that the conspiracy beliefs change depending on who's in power. So the idea of voter fraud kind of moves around the parties depending on who's in power. So one year the Democrats are in power and it's Republicans saying that is voter fraud, etc., that that's how they got in. Then the next day, you know, after the election, Republicans are out and Democrats are in. Well, then the Republicans are believing it's a voter fraud, and the Democrats are no longer believing that because they've won the election, so suddenly everything's okay. So this kind of bias that we have really impacts the evaluation that we do. And that's something that's been tracked for many years. So of course, in 2020, we saw lots of voter fraud conspiracy theories. But similarly, if the other party had won, they would still be there. Just slightly different rhetoric, but the main core would be there, that is voter fraud, which I think is really fascinating, how that belief can just change depending on how it suits our needs. So a political scientist in America says that conspiracy theories are for losers. Losers in the sense of, well, if you lose a election, you've got the desire to really explain it and to kind of, you know, other the other group. Well, they've got that via, you know, voter fraud. They've done shady things, which I think is really fascinating.
And I think this is a running theme in many of the episodes that we're doing here in this series, about the fact that human beings are tribal creatures. You know, we've evolved to live in tribes and to support the group that we're in, the in-group that we're in. And I think what many people aren't aware of is just how innate some of these tendencies are. You know, they're non-conscious bits of thinking. And there's been some incredible experiments to prove that, you know, you don't have to do anything to separate there's a minimal idea of separation out in groups. So, you know, it doesn't have to be skin color. It doesn't have to be gender or anything like that. It could just be, I don't know, selecting a different colored ball and saying, right, you know, people suddenly feel, oh, well, I've got a different ball from them, therefore we're different groups. And it's been proven that people automatically feel differently about the people who are in that other group, doesn't it?
They favoritize the in-group, and the in-group, as you say, could just be split into X or Y, and and some real kind of core experiments showed that when people split into X and Y and no information was given, so nothing else about the group, they didn't meet anyone else, then they'll ask about, you know, how much do you like your group? How much resource would you give to your group? They always prioritize that group, even though there was nothing else involved. So it makes you think that if these minimal conditions exist, what happens when someone actually values the group that they're part of, their identity, when it's part of who they are? Well, they're potentially going to be really motivated to defend that group, to have be more favorable, you know, have more positivity towards that group, and importantly, believe the other group is potentially conspiring against them.
And interestingly, it's, I think what it comes down to with some of this is it shows that it's not actually about the information. You know, we often think that it's about the content of the information that we're given. That is actually plays less of a role than we might think, because it's more about which group you belong to and whether you're seeking to justify the views of yourself and that group, really. It could almost be any piece of information.
That's absolutely true. And that's potentially why fake news, misinformation, and conspiracy theories really flourish in these kind of environments, where, of course, fake news and conspiracy theories are different things, by the sense that something can be fake and not conspiratorial. You could suggest that the group has done something, but it's not conspiratorial in the sense that they've hidden it or that they've it's for their self-interest. It can be different things, but you're right. This information is just... it's digested by your kind of blinkers, how you see that world. So it's really important for us to try and think about, well, how can we try and reduce that influence? How can we make people still have their identity, to feel close to their group, but to be able to think more clearly when they look around their surroundings? And that is a kind of a real timely question.
And I think we'll come to that a bit later in the conversation. So we've looked then at one of the kind of really big influences on people's relationship with the truth, which is people's sort of belonging to in groups and out groups and how you seek to sort of justify and back up your group against others. Perhaps another thing or other things could be internal heuristics and biases that we might have as individuals. And I guess that what I'm thinking about is this more sort of general human propensity for sort of the searching for coherence rather than truth. So we are basic creatures living in a very, very complex world, and we have to make kind of models out of the world to take the sort of simplest bits to enable us to actually operate and to be able to function and live. And it seems to me from the research that I've read that actually human beings have a tendency to search for coherence, to be able to sort of build up a picture and a story that makes sense about the world around them, rather than necessarily to seek truth. And actually that could have something to do with why, you know, why we do move on to things which aren't necessarily the truth sometimes.
That's totally fair. And I would wonder, before I kind of talk a bit more broadly, I do wonder if when people are seeking this coherence, are they in their mind's eye thinking it's the truth? So it's not that they're just subjectively thinking, I'm going to believe whatever. They're speaking coherence, but believing that is the truth. If you know what I mean? Like, I suspect if we ask people to talk about their beliefs, quite a few will say, this is what I actually do think is the truth. To other people, indeed, it may seem quite crazy, but it's quite silly. But for them, that is their core belief. So I do wonder if the coherence and the truth element kind of go hand in hand subjectively. Of course, we think about objectively at the start of the conversation around, you know, truth, what is truth? Potentially, it's their bias taking over. But I do wonder if themselves do think they're actually finding the truth. Because, of course, we, as you mentioned, we have their needs, in a way, we need for knowledge. Need for certainty. We all want to be certain in our life. When something large and uncertain happens, you know, a terrorist attack, a virus outbreak, we want to try and explain that. Similarly, we want to feel safe in the world, whereby we have control of what is happening, which of course leads to that coherence of our narratives, but having control over a situation, over a life event, where also we want to kind of make ourselves feel good as well. Make ourselves feel good and our group feel good, which means that in a particular scenario, such as, you know, a terrorist attack, such as a virus outbreak, naturally, it is a very anxious time. It's a very uncertain time. It makes you feel perilous, whereby you don't know what is happening and you actually have no control over the events that are happening potentially in your life and also arguably the world as of COVID-19. So a conspiracy belief in particular can try and meet some of those needs, believing that the event or the issue is caused by a secret group of people for the whole own hidden agenda, offers a bit more autonomy to you making decisions around what has happened. And also, in a way, it makes that the world seem more predictable. It's not that something crazy has happened that we have no control over. Rather, a group of people actually plan this, which, in a way, can try and make us feel more in control. And I say the word try, because whilst they seem appealing, they're potentially not satisfying. So people are very drawn to conspiracy theories because, you know, they want knowledge, they want to feel certain, they want to feel good. Well, believing in a conspiracy means that you believe that others are out there conspiring against you, that others are out there emboldening plots and schemes. That doesn't make you feel any better, arguably, because you then believe, well, actually, what else have they done? Because if they've been involved in this event, what else have, you know, have they conspired in? They being the government or scientists or whatever. What have they done? Which, in a way, could actually increase your mistrust of knowledge, of gatekeepers, of science, of whatever the issue is. So whilst we have this need to be coherent, I fully agree, and this need to be certain, we then develop this belief, which actually could be more maladaptive than actually anything else, whereby we may find ourselves even more ostracized from our community, because we then believe, what else are people involved in? What else are people conspiring in? Which then could impact different behaviors, etc., etc. But the key point, potentially they're appealing, but not satisfying.
Interesting. Yes. And I think that it was interesting you brought up this idea of simplicity as well, in that, you know, you were talking about, you know, people helping people to get sort of coherence about their situation, and also some sort of sense of control, but also that people do like simplicity. They like to be able to sort of say, you know, this is a black or white situation, and I've solved that, and therefore, you know, I can leave my brain processing power to deal with something else, because it's about, again, evolutionary reasons about preservation of energy. And so there are lots of reasons why we might seek that. I wonder if I could ask you about how these ideas spread. So this is sort of moving on to a slightly different area, but how fake news or conspiracy theories actually spread. Can you see some sort of, obviously there are psychological bases as to why this happens. What are some of the kind of core influences you think about how these things spread?
Well, of course, the logistics at the moment, you might suggest that social media is the pumping ground to help the spread of this information. But of course, fake news, conspiracy theories have been around for a very long time. They're not new phenomenon. They're not something that was born up with the spread of COVID-19 in the population, but rather these have existed arguably since the start of time, where the biases that we've talked about are things that are in essence maybe innate, whereby you can track back these narratives for some time. So when we think that the logistics of the spread, of course, social media maybe makes this faster, makes it much more easier to spread these rhetorics. But of course, it's not the only reason. People would spread this type of information before the internet existed. And arguably, maybe that was even more harder to try and spread things. And, you know, it was via newspapers, it was via the radio, it was via discussing things in person. So one other kind of facet that we've not talked about yet, of course, is the entertainment value of conspiracy theories. And a real interesting paper was published recently, so in early August, where they've demonstrated that people who find these types of narratives more interesting believe them more. So it doesn't obviously dispute any of the other work that people are drawn to it as a way to understand the world, as a way to, you know, address needs, to coherence. But it highlights potentially why they're also really influential, because they're just interesting. They stimulate people. They're newsworthy. They grab our attention, which means, you know, when it grabs your attention, you may be more likely to evaluate, you know, not to evaluate, but to kind of take it on board and think, okay, well, this potentially is what the world is like, which then could lead to a myriad of different things. Even more so, potentially, is that interaction between wanting to have the search for truth, for knowledge, and then finding this information that is actually really interesting and entertaining, that these things come together, and then that forms your belief, which then could lead to other rabbit holes.
And I think this is one of the things that makes it so difficult to regulate this at the moment with social media, because many of the social media and tech companies that are sort of so successful at the moment, they exist through getting people's attention. Their key aim is to get your attention. That's their, that's the sort of capital that they deal with. And therefore, if you're asking them to do things that are actually going to try and pull, you know, not pull people's attention, stuff that they know is incredibly effective, that's a very difficult ask to make of them from a commercial sense. You're almost asking them to do something that's sort of anathema to them. So that causes problems, I would guess.
That's such a really interesting point. And I think you're totally right, where we talk about these things could spread because of the entertainment value, but that is a core value of Facebook, of Twitter. It's to try and get people talking. It's to try and get trending topics. It's to keep people, in a way, on their platform, communicating with each other and maybe taking in other things. So an interesting example of that I know is around the 5G suggested link with COVID-19, whereby 5G conspiracy theories have been around for a little while, suggesting that there's something hidden with them, that it's been linked to cancer, it's been covered up. That rhetoric existed for a little while. And when COVID came around, it kind of fit the kind of same narrative. Well, COVID is caused by 5G. And whilst there was evidence to suggest that it's not true, this rhetoric, for someone who may be seeking answers, seeking the truth, has that, you know, entertainment value, it potentially was quite appealing to believe in that kind of rhetoric, which means that people started talking about this conspiracy on Facebook. And because there was a bit of more interest, maybe because COVID made it a fertile ground for conspiracy theories, so there's a bit more people maybe kind of getting involved, the algorithm, thought it was a trending topic, which brought it up into the trending pages of platforms, indeed Twitter as well, Facebook and Twitter, because they thought it was a topic to discuss about, so they being the algorithm. But of course, bringing it into the mainstream, in a way, meant that it got much larger reach than it had ever got before. And really interesting, there's some like computer scientists were able to kind of map the spread of that particular piece of information, how it came. Suddenly, it's been asked, you know, in a prime minister's question time around, you know, the link between 5G and COVID, and him talking about obviously it not being true, etc. But that kind of shows potentially the reach of misinformation, conspiracy theories being taken up by Facebook inadvertently, thinking it's a topic that's been discussed, and suddenly we find ourselves, you know, having it in the mainstream media, which I think is a real interesting example of that happening.
I think this is absolutely fascinating. And it sounds like one of the next question I was going to ask you was, is there evidence of how conspiracy theories start? But in a way, you've almost explained it there, in that it feels like very much like how you make a snowball. that something small just gathers effect, gathers, and sort of further people sort of jump onto it and are interested in it. But the fact that this is now in the modern world enabled by social media outlets, that enables the snowball to get to grow in size. But I think the really interesting thing is, though, because of social media, because it's so powerful these days, that once it gets a certain size on social media, it actually becomes a story in itself. Whether or not it's a load of old baloney or not, it will then somehow transfer onto the BBC, and other sources of news, which are respected, supposedly sources of news. So it shows how this can actually transfer over. So something that could be a load of old nonsense into even mainstream news, and it becomes just because it's a popular belief.
Well, of course, another context or to add to that particular example is, whilst it was growing on the trending pages, lots of people were calling out for the pylons who are causing COVID-19 to be set alight. So there were many examples of pylons that are thought to be 5G, that often they weren't, were set alight. So of course, that is what grabbed the media attention, was the state of play with what was happening. And whilst the question to the Prime Minister was about 5G, it was in the context of the pylons being set alight and the radicalisation, in essence, of conspiracy theories, which I imagine, even if that action didn't happen in the real world, it was still a trending topic, and it may indeed have been talked about anyway. But it was more the physical outreach, in a way, of things being set alight that caught the attention. Which it's impossible to say, you know, whether that trending page impacted that. It certainly meant that more people were seeing this information. But of course, as we know from some research, that just because you believe in a conspiracy doesn't mean you're going to go out and act in a very violent way. It very much depends on your personality, your feelings, your kind of draw to action to whether you go and actually do it. So potentially those people who are already in the community may have always been the likely ones to act in that really radical way. But nonetheless, the example still there as showing the influence of the internet. But I imagine that belief would have existed even without the internet, and it just may not have been as fast.
And I wonder, the next thing I wanted to ask was just in terms of the people themselves. You know, are some people more vulnerable than others to conspiracy theories and these sorts of ideas?
To people who are shown to be ostracized, marginalized, are susceptible to believing conspiracies. Potentially, it couples with a desire to feel unique, to feel different, that this information can be really appealing, that you feel that you have some knowledge that other people do not have. So potentially, people who are quite vulnerable, maybe, are susceptible because it kind of meets some of the needs that they have. Another real interesting caveat is the links with discrimination and victimhood. By the fact that if you have had someone out to get you previously because maybe it was your sexuality, your ethnicity, whatever it is, that may make you more likely to believe in conspiracies in the future. So an example I have of this is if you, in a sample of gay males, if they had experienced discrimination based on their sexuality, they were more likely to believe in conspiracies about HIV that human made, which was then also associated with them being less likely to want to get PrEP, which is a biomedical therapy to, you know, for people who are susceptible towards HIV. So it's potentially their life experience, whereby if your group also has been, you know, a victim of discrimination in other areas, not just sexuality, well, then potentially you're susceptible to believe, well, what else have people been doing? Potentially, it's a way to maybe protect your group because, well, if we've been burnt before, well, let's try and stop ourselves being burnt in the future. Which, of course, is also really problematic because what they're basing their experience on, their belief on, arguably is the truth. Well, it's the truth that they have been discriminated against by a certain group. But when I say the word arguably, because it's trying to build that trust that things are different in the future. That because the government has done bad things one day doesn't mean they're going to do bad things the other day. But it's easy to say that as someone who isn't a victim, who, you know, hasn't got that particular experience. But also really interesting, there I've talked about real experience of victimhood, but also the perception of victimhood is also really powerful. So some research has found that the perception that your group is a victim is also a driver of conspiracy theories. And they found that this perception was across different social demographic lines. So it didn't matter if your group was high status or low status. If you believed your group was discriminated against, you believed people were out to get you. Which can also help explain why, you know, Democrats and Republicans believe in conspiracies. Why different ethnicities believe in conspiracies. Because potentially it's that subjectiveness on it. Which I always find quite interesting to think about, where it's the actual and also the perception that seems to be driving this belief. So maybe it's just down to how you see the world and your potential life experiences, which again can make interventions really interesting, of how we try and, in a way, support people through the trauma, arguably, of being a victim. And whether it's real or whether it's perceived, potentially the feeling is still quite powerful. But so it's quite an interesting topic to think about how we kind of tackle conspiracy theories when it's based on true experience.
I think another thing that was really interesting reading about who takes up conspiracy theories and what are some of the influences behind it is that it's not necessarily based on how well-informed people are or how intelligent people are. And I think, you know, some of the research has said that actually you can be incredibly well-informed about things and still believe in conspiracy theories. And actually you're using that sort of intellectual engine and that information you're getting to actually just justify your belief in that. So that it's about I think going back to what we were talking about at the start, it's about how you use that piece of information to justify your own beliefs. So it isn't about, you know, I think there's a common thought about, oh, anybody who's interested in conspiracy theories are not as bright as anybody else. That is not the case. And the science leads us to believe that. Is that, would that be correct?
Definitely. So if you were, when we look at the data, there is a link between education and conspiracy theory, but it's not as straightforward as you may think. Education often breeds the idea that complex problems cannot be explained by simple solutions. It breeds our critical thinking abilities, which then means that we're less likely to believe in conspiracies. So potentially someone who is educated may not have developed some of those skill sets. Potentially, just because you go for education doesn't mean you may develop your critical thinking skills, which means that we could find situations where someone is quite educated, but is using some of the biases that we all have to kind of govern the world. So whilst in general, there is links between education and conspiracy theories, it is always quite complex. And of course, you'll always find people who, with their educational background, may not have the skills that we think. And, you know, we know that people who believe in conspiracies subjectively believe they're being a critical thinker, but objectively, they're shown not to be. Which I think is also an interesting caveat in that people are asking questions, but are then actually evaluating the evidence potentially. Or rather, they think they are, but in objective reality, they're not. Because it's maybe based on that prior belief, that belief to believe the other group is conspiring. So maybe the education is there, but the skill sets maybe aren't as developed or as, you know, as taught as well as we may like.
It's about a certain set of kind of critical thinking skills and the ability to process and reflect on information. And
absolutely, which of course can be given by education. But, you know, if that student wasn't part of your education, you didn't engage in it, you may find someone who's quite educated but may not have those skill sets readily available.
Okay, so we'll move towards in a moment of the idea of solutions, what we can do to try and combat some of this. I thought it would be very interesting just to explore, you know, what might be some of the consequences of believing in conspiracy theories? Because I think one of the things that I'm interested in exploring at the moment is this idea of, as a hypothesis that perhaps there is a bit of a slippery slope when you start believing in conspiracy theories, in that, you know, you get perhaps taken into maybe a rather sort of cynical view of the mainstream world and a cynical view of information that's out there, previously information that might have been seen as objectively truthful. And that actually it can turn you into alternative sources of information that aren't correct and that actually could lead you down some fairly dangerous paths. I wonder what you think of that, you know, this idea that perhaps it leads you to feeling cynicism towards not just the mainstream, but to other groups and in towards parts of, for example, social media or the internet where these sort of conspiracy theories lie, where other things can lie. And if you start getting your information from that area and being among those groups, you could start feeling antipathy and hatred towards other groups that could send you down a rather nasty path. Do you think there is potential for that? Or is there any evidence to support other thoughts on that?
I mean, definitely, because of course, these beliefs can change how we see the world. And arguably, rightly so. If you believe that the government is involved in plots and schemes, well, that's going to change how I see the government in different areas of my life. Because, you know, if they're lying about climate change, are they lying about vaccines? Are they lying about different world events? You know, 9/11, different terrorist attacks. That makes sense that someone who's in this rabbit hole will believe those different things. But of course, it's problematic because it's not based in reality, it's not based in truth, whereby shown to be the truth of what has actually happened. So, of course, someone who then believes that the government or doctors or whatever are involved in these plots and schemes, well, then they're going to act in a very different way towards those groups. So a tangible example of that is the hatred and violence we're seeing towards NHS staff. I'm not sure if you see it in the news or on your news feed at least, but there's many doctors coming out to say the hate they are receiving because they're believed to be part of a conspiracy to do with COVID-19, to do with the vaccine or COVID itself, which I think is a real direct impact of misinformation and conspiracy theories, whereby the beliefs are motivating people to act in this very hateful way. So whilst we may think of groups as other groups of people, sexuality, ethnicity, but it could also be groups of people like NHS staff who are at the front of, you know, violence, arguably. I don't know of any actual physical acts yet. I say the word yet, but I know there's been lots of examples of hatred online and in person, and lots of, you know, worry around this. So I think you're totally right that these beliefs can spin off to impacting other groups that, you know, are, in the case of NHS staff, trying to help us through the pandemic. And of course, this isn't just unique to the UK. We've seen these types of rhetorics and this type of action in other countries, which, you know, highlights how conspiracy theories are, you know, in a way, universal. That they obviously have different rhetorics around the world, but this, the kind of fundamentals still exist. And that's quite problematic. And that's just one example of conspiracy theories having arguably an offline impact. But of course, if I believe the vaccines are not safe and I dislike the NHS, well, I'm not going to want to get a vaccine. I'm not going to want to follow advice around COVID-19. Of course, I'm using examples from COVID-19 because it's so prevalent in my life, your life, everyone's life at the moment. But other examples could be, of course, with climate change. If you believe it's a hoax, the world scientists are lying, well, why would I reduce my carbon footprint? If it's all just a hoax, why would I bother doing that? If I believe that others are conspiring, why would I? Why don't I conspire as well? Conspiring in the sense of maybe acting unethically, maybe not following social norms as closely as others. Because, well, if they're not, why would I want to do that as well?
I mean, I guess it feels to me the danger is that that if you go into a conspiracy theory group, if you have a conspiracy theory belief on something for very good reason, that everybody's trying to make a sort of coherent set of views for themselves and support the world. For example, if you're going in there as an anti-vaxxer, the worry is that there's a potential danger that even by sort of seeding that one false belief, the person then gets into a community and a sort of set of information, which means that they're cynical about everything else in the mainstream, which then from that starting point of kind of going in with quite good reasons to try and find out something, you could then sort of find yourself within a pool of other information, which is pretty nasty, and that crosses over into other things like politics or race. So I guess that's the sort of concern I would see from my perspective, is that can put you into almost like a kind of intellectual trap where you're surrounded by this group and this source of information, which makes you just cynical about everything, but very susceptible to hateful and other messages from within that group.
Absolutely. And, you know, if I try and flip the coin and I see myself as believing one conspiracy, well, I'm going to believe many others. For me, that is a rational thing for me to be doing, because it's my view of the world. I see the world as full of conspiracies, so that is going to be my worldview. And then from our side, we're looking into it, well, that is pretty problematic by the fact that you are believing in different things because it meets this worldview of yours, but this worldview is not based in reality. It's based in false information. It's a conspiracy theory that is impacting how you see other information. But for that individual, it's potentially quite a rational thing to be doing. Rational in the sense that they have a coherent story in their mind of the world. But for us looking on, actually that is not rational at all. It's based, you know, it's maladaptive. And arguably, if there was no real consequence of holding that belief, well, then it's quite a good thing to have. Like, if you believed in something that made sense and that the world was explained and it had no direct consequence on society or yourself, well, that I see is a good thing. If you can find something that brings you pleasure, that makes you feel better, happy days. But of course, what we've demonstrated in the research is that it's not true. That your belief network, arguably rightly so, governs how you interact with the world. So if you believe, you know, conspiracies around certain world events, you're going to act in a very negative way to the world. You're going to be very sociable because you believe it's all part of a conspiracy. So whilst it has the, I was about to start, whilst it seems quite appealing, it's quite good, I think, potentially to believe in a conspiracy, you then look at the consequences and you think, well, actually, it's not good at all. It's not satisfying. It's actually quite detrimental that this belief that may have helped us back evolutionary, maybe, to be suspicious of other people, actually is not helping us right now. It's potentially really maladaptive. And that is quite problematic.
So for the final part of this discussion then, let's perhaps look to the future and where things might go and how we might improve things. From what we're talking about, it sounds to me like in the last few hundred years, we found a rather uneasy balance between seeking the truth and still being very susceptible to and enjoying stories and other things that aren't true. And that we live in society within this uneasy balance between the two. And I wondered what you thought, you know, is there any reason why the primacy of the truth should survive in the future?
Good question. We're always going to want to obviously seek the truth, because that is mentioned right at the start. Human nature is part of our, you know, innate kind of desires that we have. And rightly so, because we want to know what the truth is. So it's thinking about what will the future look like with regards to that. We want people, I want myself, to ask questions. It's important that we always ask questions. The key is around the evaluation of evidence. So, you know, at the start, the questions around, back another example of COVID, you know, is the vaccine safe? How has it been developed? Etc., etc. Those, I think, are valid questions. Those are valid questions to ask. And that's why the communication around the vaccine was really important, because it needed to communicate the answers to those important questions. Those aren't conspiratorial. The conspiratorial elements come where the facts, in my words, are given, but people doubt it. People have this overriding suspicion. In essence, they're immune to evidence. So they ignore what has been said by scientists, etc. So that is a key example for me of us asking questions, but then having the abilities to be able to evaluate the evidence. And of course, the abilities are clouded by our prior beliefs, our desire to believe the other group is conspiring, to do with our personality, to do with, you know, the need to feel unique, the need to have a simple explanation. Because, of course, lots of the answers given by the scientists were a little bit complicated. Complicated because they are complicated. And it's hard to break it down to black and white sometimes. Because it's a debate topic. Some people will have discussions around it. So when you look towards the science, sometimes it's not that clean, simple answer. When you look towards the conspiracy theory, it offers that simple answer. So someone who is asking the question may be drawn to that conspiracy theory. So in a way, the future is trying to help people to ask the questions and empower them to ask the questions, but then also to get them to stop and evaluate the evidence and to make an informed choice on that evidence, so that they're not just, for example, Googling something and finding the top hit and believing that, but rather stopping and thinking, is this top hit on Google making me feel really happy or really angry or really sad? And if it is, just stop and think about that. Why is that? Is it because it's true or because it meets my prior beliefs? It meets that opportunity to hate towards the out-group. Is that the reason why I'm liking it? Or actually, is it something else? Stopping and thinking, which I think potentially could be a real interesting one to think about how we digest information. And there's been nudges so far. So if you're a Twitter user, you may have noticed that they get you to think about something before you retweet it. So have you read the article? And then, you know, you stop and think. And sometimes I'm like, yes, I've read it already. Or sometimes I'm like, yes, I should read that. Which I think that sort of prime is getting people to stop and think before they share information, which of course could be the truth or it could be misinformation. So that kind of nudges, I think, are real interesting. That's something that the social media companies are involved in and, you know, shown to have some success on the spread of misinformation. Stop and think.
It sounds like you're also suggesting that there is perhaps a need to, within the education system, help people to develop some of these critical thinking skills of information literacy, media literacy, critical thinking, to actually prioritize those much more in the modern world within the way that we educate kids and adults.
Absolutely. So in the UK, at least, the digital literacy is not a key cornerstone of our education, which on one hand, I'm thinking, well, what, that's crazy. How is that not happening in our current world? But on the other hand, there's so much on the curriculum. There's so much that's already included. So a kind of argument is, well, if we include this, what is removed? Which I think is also an interesting question to think about as well. But from my angle, I think it's really important that we do tackle this in young people as well. So some research that I have published recently highlighted that age 14 appears to be a peak age to develop conspiracy theories. Because at age 14, that is where you are looking towards your friends and your family. It's where, when your friends rather than your family, shall I say, where you are also relying less on your emotional regulation abilities, i.e. when you feel that anxiety, that anger, you're more likely to feel it and kind of regulate it. And that it gets better as a person ages, but age 14 seems to be a peak time where emotional regulation is kind of teased apart a little bit, which means that someone who feels that anxiety, someone who maybe is looking towards all the information, may find these conspiracy theories really appealing, which could be a reason why it develops then. But we don't know for certain. We don't know. These are just ideas of why age 14 could be that peak time. So potentially, if young people were given some of the skill sets around digital literacy, around how to evaluate information, how to spot fake news, how to, in essence, to think a little bit more about evidence, that could be a good time to kind of target it, whereby we ensure the students are empowered to ask questions, but that's, you know, that's a key cornerstone of our society, but has the abilities to evaluate in the online world. So I think it's a real kind of we'll kind of work together on that in a way, because we don't want a world where people just don't ask questions. And that's something that sometimes conspiracy theorists may say, oh, you just want a world that, you know, you just believe what you're told. That is not true at all. In my humble opinion, that's not true at all. It's the asking the questions element that is really important, but it's the evaluation that's also equally.
It feels as well, I mean, I think we've just talked there about things that we can do as a society to help individuals to build up skills in the way that they think and nudges and things like that. I wonder if there's also some broader stuff that we should be doing as a society, perhaps even sort of putting up the idea of the truth as a priority in society. Because I think it's very easy for people to have a form of, I would call it kind of almost like information cynicism, where we are, if those around us, whether it's leaders or corporations or whoever, aren't behaving in a truthful way or don't seem to be valuing truth at all, and saying, well, that you can have any interpretation of anything you like, you know, that it's anything goes, then actually people will naturally develop a more cynical view of how things are and say, well, look, it's actually all just a menu. It's just information. I can have whatever I like. Mm. And that, you know, we take, for example, you know, how our governments perhaps have behaved during the Brexit campaign, or how Donald Trump deals with fake news and things like that, that actually this, to me, breeds a great deal of cynicism from everybody in the idea of the truth. And actually, perhaps there is something much bigger there, that our leaders and as a society, we need to be putting the truth up actually much more on a pedestal and saying, well, actually, no, this really matters. And we as leaders are going to be, you know, we want you to judge us on how closely we stick to that. And we want you as the public to, you know, seek the truth. That feels like a pretty fundamental thing to do, because otherwise it's just one of many menu options of information.
I subscribe to that viewpoint, but I can imagine a counter argument to be, well, we are searching for the truth. You are part of a world conspiracy. We want the truth. We are searching for the truth. So it's back to that subjectiveness where looking for coherent arguments and the desire to have the truth, but are doubting the facts in a way. So it's trying to, in a way, it's trying to think about how we deal with those kind of already formed beliefs, by that potentially the skill set we talked about a moment ago will help before the beliefs are formed, when they're able to develop ideas around how you truth seek and how you evaluate in a way. But for someone who already has that belief, who when you might, they may hear that statement around, you know, truth's really important, they are going to go, well, yes, it absolutely is. And that's where we're working to showcase how you are a liar, which I think could be, for me, kind of highlights how maybe interventions deal with groups slightly differently. Groups being those who are yet to form a conspiracy belief and those who already have it as part of their belief system, a part of their identity. And maybe we deal with it slightly differently.
I think that that's a very good point. And I think, I guess the point I was making is that that idea of putting the truth up there as an important thing is what you would do for the majority of people as an ongoing thing. But I think it's a very good point in that actually there need to be some solutions in place for people who are already within that bubble of conspiracy theories and thinking like that. Mm-hmm. What is there? I mean, this is a really tricky question. Is there anything one can do when people are within those sorts of groups?
So often these beliefs are seen to be extremist beliefs, which means that lots of literature in the extremist belief in general area can help inform conspiracy theory research. As in, we know that people who are seen to be part of the group who maybe have left can actually be quite influential. So when they come back and they're kind of talking about their experience, can be influential in changing someone's mind. In a way, having a trusted messenger to talk to someone about their beliefs. It could be someone who's left the belief recently, or you know, family or friend. Could be a real kind of interesting person to engage that conspiracy theorist with those beliefs. But also it could be not necessarily trying to debunk someone's belief, but trying to get people to talk about the values that they both share. So arguably everyone will share, you know, the values around critical thinking, to think critically, to ask questions and to evaluate. So bringing a conversation where you highlight that shared identity and talking about this, in essence, the skill sets around what we've talked about, could be one way to kind of get someone to reevaluate. So it's not giving them facts and saying, read this, this is the truth, but rather getting them to think about ways to evaluate evidence and then in their own time to start to think through more clearly. Arguably, because one way it's just one suggestion. Of course, it'd be very challenging to get someone to engage in that, and it will be over a long period of time rather than, you know, one conversation. But something else that's also interesting that I've saw is when the conspiracy is shown not to be true. So a good example of that is with QAnon, whereby it was all leading up to in the kind of Trump coming out and highlighting what he's been doing, the part of, you know, a paedophile ring that he's uncovered, and it was all part of a set date. And when that date came and nothing happened, lots of people, not everyone, but lots of people kind of realised, well, actually, this is not true. Like, I've been working towards this shining light, and actually, it's not actually happened. Which means that they were then able to think a bit more clearly, in a way, of what the surroundings are. And lots of support groups came up, for example, on Reddit, for people to kind of help each other through seeing the light, in a way. Which I think is quite a unique example of a conspiracy coming out to be shown to be false, in a way. Because when it's about vaccines, about climate change, there's no real endpoint. Like, you know, it's not like something that's going to happen. Like, in our lifetime, we're not going to see climate change. Well, we are seeing, but like, not like the full extent of it, which means that someone's not going to be fully kind of having that moment of, oh my God, potentially. Whereas with QAnon and the Trump, it was a clear line in the sand. And of course, you know, some people went down on it and said, oh no, something else would happen. They're going to wait. But lots of other people didn't do that. And another example that I have in that kind of area is with the Sandy Hook shooting, where there's lots of conspiracy saying it's a red flag, which means that people believe it's all fake, that it never actually happened. And a parent who had a child who was murdered as part of the Sandy Hook was actually a conspiracy theorist beforehand. He believed in 9/11, etc., and was apparently quite vocal about that. But when his child was murdered, and he saw the rhetorics around people saying his child never existed, it kind of opened his eyes to, well, actually, I'm suddenly part of a conspiracy that actually is not a conspiracy. Like, my child actually was murdered. And that changed his viewpoint. And he came out and he did some blogs about his experience, and him being a part of this has changed his worldview. But again, it's a very unique example. There's not many examples that offer that opportunity to, you know, see the light. So I think it's quite an interesting way to come out of the rabbit hole, but I don't know if it's going to work for all conspiracies or for everyone. They're quite unique quite unique endpoints in a way, which you would want in anyone.
Yeah, so it's that tricky thing, isn't it, for people who are already within these groups about, it's not just about, or it's often not about offering them alternative information, because just meeting information with information, they can always interpret it in the way they want to. It's about perhaps helping them to kind of come out of that group somehow and finding a way that is, again, coherent with them and that actually doesn't damage their own identity to do that. It's almost like being an apostate, I guess, in some ways, and actually being able to help people out in that way. But it's almost only going to be when people are ready, isn't it? And it's actually quite a difficult thing, because it's not something you can say to everybody, right, you know, come out, we've got enough arguments for you to come out, that must convince you. You know, it's actually going to be, people will have to do it of their own volition, I would imagine.
That is such a good point, that it's it's a person wanting to come out, and maybe those people who didn't with the QAnon part didn't come out because they didn't want to. They liked the community element. They liked probably feeling a part of, they know something. Whereas other people developed other communities as a way to get the support that they may have received as being a part of QAnon. Because of course, I can certainly imagine, like for example, going to a rally around anti-vaccines, and you got your placard, and you're part of a little group who are chanting. I can imagine that to be quite empowering, because we know that being a part of a protest in general can be really empowering, you know, experience to be part of. So for someone who maybe has felt alienated, ostracized, to suddenly feel part of that community where, you know, it's empowering in that regard of, you know, social connections, I think that's typically really appealing. So you may find someone maybe doesn't want to give up the conspiracy belief because they lose that connection. Now, I have no data on that at all. It's just me thinking my experience potentially of being a part of that kind of collective. So it could be, you know, interesting way to think about it.
And I think one of the things that we haven't mentioned as we've discussed this is about identity as an individual, because I think we've talked a lot about, you know, perhaps heuristics we might have in the way that we process information and make sense of the world. We've talked about how we fit within groups and form in groups and out groups, but our own sense of identity and this sense of wanting to feel like a valued, useful human being is actually really key here as well. And I think with our beliefs, we bind ourselves to our beliefs, don't we? And if one of the reasons we hold on to them so hard is that if we're proved to be wrong, then that can dismantle our sense of who we are, and it can make us feel bad about ourselves. And I think a lot of us are desperate to hang on to that. So it feels like one of the ways that you can help people to sort of let go of that stuff is to say, well, look, you know, you're not an idiot if you change your mind here. You know, it's about enabling people to give them a little sort of a ramp, a gentle ramp to come out of it, where rather than a sort of a push off a cliff to go, no, you were completely wrong, you're an idiot, you know, and actually feel that sense of self, still feeling a sense of firm sense of identity, and that actually, no, you are an intelligent, you know, youthful person. You know, it's just that you have stood back and you've readjusted your views.
That's a really good point. And in a way, for me, it's thinking about it as a journey into a conspiracy theorist mentality, but also out of it. And sometimes I refer to people as, you know, non-conspiratorial, conspiratorial, as kind of a binary thing, where, of course, in reality, that is not true. People are going to be on a different continuum of how strong their beliefs are. It's not that if you suddenly read something conspiratorial right now, pick up my phone, that I suddenly am a conspiracy theorist. Rather, it's going to be a process whereby I may change my beliefs over a period of time. And indeed, it may be that I never actually arguably say I'm a conspiracy theorist, because of course, saying that I am comes with lots of negativity, the suggestion of stereotypes that I'm paranoid, that I have a well-tinful hat. That's something that people are not going to want to identify with, arguably. So someone may actually never identify themselves as a conspiracy theorist. But nonetheless, for me, it's that journey. And when I talk about conspiracy theorists, I talk about kind of a group of people who are maybe high endorsers, or who are those who are medium endorsers, which again, is quite subjective of how we talk about that continuum, where as someone who does lots of questionnaires, I see people on a continuum. But of course, it's all based in someone's language as well, and how they talk about the events that are happening, and whether they believe someone is involved in plots and schemes. But I think going back to your particular point, is it's getting someone to kind of think about their identity and kind of get them off slowly, which highlights my thought process that it's a journey to it and potentially out of it as well. It's not just, you know, you click your finger and suddenly you're no longer a conspiracy theorist, because, well, actually, what actually is that?
And I think one final question just on solutions or ways of approaching this. Do you think there's a place in this for regulation at all of media and information? I'm thinking not necessarily just about sort of banning things, although you may sort of talk about that. The other thing is about almost labeling information to be able to say, well, look, here are trustworthy sites. Here are sites that we're worried about that aren't so trustworthy. Do you think there is a place for that? I mean, we're starting to get slightly into that in social media these days, but I'm thinking more in terms of broader information about where we get our information from.
That's a real good point. And of course, banning misinformation, banning conspiracy theories is problematic in the sense that, well, sometimes we don't know what the truth is until it's investigated. So someone may have a question, a legitimate question, that then needs to be investigated. So examples around 5G, there were studies that took place to work out what are the health consequences of 5G. And of course, they were shown that they don't cause cancer, etc. But then that needs time for that to happen. So there needs to be the scientific element or the truth seeking or whatever it is to say what the truth is. So someone needs a place to ask questions. But there also needs to be somehow a mechanism where when that question is answered or whatever it is, that then it's flagged as something that's problematic in the future. But of course, those things are hard to kind of police because, you know, when sometimes it can take a little while before, you know, the science is available to highlight the health impact of a particular new technology. So if something was labelled as fake news immediately, well, then we don't know if it's fake news. So potentially that's where working with fact checkers is really important, where they're able to see bits of information and can fact check it. And things that are maybe shown to not be sure, they flag. We don't know yet. When things are false, they flag it's false. And sometimes I've seen fact checkers do this live on, you know, political statements. So Trump was fact checked live because obviously he used to say some real interesting things. So people will be fact checking what he's saying there and then, which I think could be an interesting way to think about how we navigate the online world. But that's not going to be also an immediate thing because, of course, the fact checkers take time to fact check. So he may be posts stay up for a little while without us knowing whether it's true or not. So maybe it's going back to some of the education whereby it's digital literacy. So we're checking to see who's written it. Where's it posted? If it's a random blog post, maybe we kind of evaluate the person's bias themselves. What's their expertise? You know, if I suddenly did a blog post on vaccines and also on the makeup of a vaccine and, you know, how it's been developed, I don't know. I'm not a vaccine scientist. I don't even know the word for vaccine scientists. If, however, I talk about, you know, the psychology of conspiracy theories or misinformation or in general, our human nature to believe information, well, then I'm trustworthy in that way. I'm an expert in that field. So in a way, it's thinking about the bias of the author as well. So potentially I can imagine the world where we find fact checkers are, you know, helping us navigate the unknown world. But also I think it's also the individual and society, in a way, having some of the skills to help them do that as well, whereby, you know, I'm not sharing something about vaccines from someone who has no idea. I'm sharing for someone who's a doctor, who has the expertise in that particular area, which is also kind of the idealistic world, in a way, because I know myself that when you're scrolling on Facebook, you don't always fact check. You just kind of read it and go, well, that sounds interesting, and then move into the next thing. But of course, that's still potentially impacting my beliefs and how I see the world. So it's trying to make you digest information, but in a way that's actually likely to be used.
So final question. How do you think this will all work out in the longer term? What do you think is the best we can hope for in having a society that, you know, that seeks the truth, or that in just preventing the spread of fake news and conspiracy theories and things like that? Where do you see this going in the longer term?
I think potentially because we've got more knowledge about this topic, us being public has more knowledge around this, that when another large event happens, and it will happen before we know it, that people may be more susceptible to think, well, actually, is this true or not? Which I think maybe is a good step in the right direction. As in, is it true or not? They won't just believe it straight away. Because of the rhetoric we've had around truth and importance and how things potentially aren't always what they seem, i.e. based around 5G and COVID-19. It's not always as one may seem when we see it online. So potentially, maybe it's been too optimistic, that when something big happens in the future, people will be ready to think, okay, well, let's just see what has been said about this. But of course, we may fall into the same trap as we've discussed so far, that when that big event happens, we feel uncertain, we feel desire to be in control, we want coherency, and we find that conspiracy interesting when we see it on Twitter. But hopefully that isn't what happens.
If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to the whole series from wherever you get your podcasts or via my website, richarddockra.com. While you're there, you can check out my other podcasts and books and sign up for my monthly newsletter containing interesting ideas and updates. Thanks for listening.